Welcome to Voices for Biodiversity's podcast. In this podcast, Nejma Belarbi interviews Louisa Maffey about biocultural diversity.
So what is terra lingua, if you could explain it in plain terms?
Well, it's a Salt Spring-based, international in scope, nonprofit organization founded in 1996. Around the idea that biodiversity, cultural diversity, and linguistic diversity are all manifestations of the diversity of life. They are interconnected and interdependent. So if you're thinking of maintaining the vitality of life on the planet, then you have to think of maintaining this interconnected biocultural web of life.
Terra Lingua is a Salt Spring-based international nonprofit organization devoted to protecting and sustaining the biocultural diversity of life, the diversity of life in nature, culture, and languages. All three diversities are, as we see it, interconnected and interdependent. Sustaining the web of life means sustaining biodiversity and the diversity of human languages and cultures around the world, and the connection of people and the land and people and the natural environment. And that's what we've been doing since 1996 through a integrated program of research, policy, advocacy, education, outreach, as well as on-the-ground projects with indigenous communities, indigenous peoples, and local communities.
Great. Can you tell me about these initiatives that you've been involved in, that Terra Lingua has been involved in?
Well, we started out really at the global level because of this idea of the interconnectedness of the diversity of life. We took from the start a kind of a planetary perspective. And so One of the first projects that we did was a mapping project in which we map the overlap between the distribution of global biodiversity and the diversity of languages, which we took to represent or as a proxy for cultural diversity at large. That was because there were maps of the distribution of languages and there were no maps of the distribution of cultures. And so it was possible to do that. But it also makes sense because, of course, languages are a key part of cultural identity. They convey cultural knowledge. And so even if there isn't a one-to-one correspondence between languages and cultures, it was good enough a proxy. And that work, interestingly enough, was done early on when we had just started as Terra Lingua in collaboration with the World Wildlife Fund. They found us and heard that we were involved in this kind of work, and they asked us whether we would help literally put people on the map of their ecosystem-based conservation. They had just developed this new approach, and they had maps of the world's ecoregions, but there were no people on the map. Some of the people within WWF felt that that was a big gap. So we had this incredible opportunity to help fill that gap. And because of that collaboration, the map and the report that we wrote to go along with it went a long way, in a sense, launched the work that we've done since with Terra Lingua. We are thinking that languages and cultures are in a crisis, language endangerment, cultural endangerment, but how do you show that? There were no indicators corresponding to the indicators that have been developed for the, you know, the trends in biodiversity. So we felt that it was necessary to develop something equivalent in order to be able to provide evidence of what was happening. And so that was work that Dave Harmon, the co-founder of Terra Lingua, and another colleague, Jonathan Lowe, took on to first develop an index of biocultural diversity that compare data on the world's languages with data on biodiversity. And then from there, they decided to go deeper in terms of gathering trends on the state of the world's languages, and so they subsequently developed an index of linguistic diversity. With these tools, we did a lot of policy work at the international level at the beginning, participating in, you know, the big meetings of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and other large gatherings of conservationists to really push for this perspective that you couldn't do biodiversity conservation without taking into account the people who actually lived in those places that of high biodiversity that you wanted to conserve. You know, the maps helped show that coincidence of distribution. So the so-called hotspots of biodiversity were also places of high cultural diversity. The interaction and interdependence of people and the environment happens everywhere, but it also has this geographic pattern that there is more density of biodiversity and more density of different peoples in the tropical equatorial regions. The distribution is most sparse in the higher latitudes. The interdependence and interconnectedness is the same, whether you are a Sami or an indigenous person in the Amazon. So it is obviously not to say that that interconnection doesn't exist everywhere. So those were the beginnings. A lot of research and policy and dissemination. We have moved from there to wanting to do more education and outreach to bring this perspective not only to academics and policy people or conservationists, but really as part of general understanding among the general public and in schools and so on. So that's what we're focusing more right now. And you know, our magazine, Landscape Magazine, which started as a simple newsletter, an organizational newsletter, started turning into an actual magazine with stories from all over the world about 10 years ago. In 2008, it's now become our major tool for spreading ideas. And thanks to our current collaborator, Corinne, is getting more and more on social media. Hopefully, within the next few months, we'll be able to develop systematic campaigns to make people aware. The point is that protecting biocultural diversity doesn't just happen on the ground. It happens in the minds, and in fact, it starts there. It has to begin with a change in the way people think. So that's what we specialize in. There's a lot of work that happens and needs to happen on the ground, but you really have to start at both ends. And so that's what we're doing more of now.
Yeah.
In fact, the interesting thing, you know, if you going back to mapping, if you look not at a global level map, which by necessity doesn't have a lot of detail, but regional maps, you do as David did as a part of his work on the State of Environment Report for Canada. You map the ecoregions of a place and then look at the distribution of the indigenous peoples of that same place. You get an almost perfect overlap because people did organize themselves by bioregions. And so the adaptations were obviously based on what kind of environment they were living in. Mm-hmm. And the way people would range, that's why you get, for instance, higher concentrations of different peoples in tropical areas, because those are extremely rich and lush, and you don't need to range too far in order to provide for yourself. And instead, say, in northern regions or desert regions, you have to have a much wider territory on which to range. And that really determines, to a large extent, your adaptations, your way of life, and one at the same time, of course, that you modify the environment for your needs. But those modifications are, or traditionally have not been, much greater than whatever modification other species can make in their own environment in providing for themselves. There was so much more attunement to ecological limits, recognition that you can't take more than your environment can reproduce, you take no more than you need, and so on and so forth. All of those precepts we have so completely forgotten. And, you know, now you go in and extract as much as you can. You extract not even what you need, but also what you don't, like with clear-cut logging or the fishing methods that are in use now, where, you know, with trawling, you catch everything and completely devastate the sea bottoms and so on and so forth. So there was nothing like that in traditional societies. For instance, the fishing methods of the Saanich people here with reef net fishing, where they would know where the salmon would come and they would put their nets there, but the nets had holes in the middle to let part of the salmon run escape so that they could continue on their voyage and ensure
that there would be in the next generation, and the cycle would continue.
Alice, the world is run by the banks. The banks are the central thing, not the churches anymore, in every village and every town. And it's all the credit, the easy credit. The banks themselves can borrow on margin, so they can extend more credit, and the credit companies extend more credit, and everything becomes easy and easy, so that there's all the inducements to just consume, and companies are looking at all the inducements to make money. Mm-hmm. So it's all a money thing, we've lost touch with any realities. You know, we buy things, and there's no connection between what we do and the natural world anymore. It's almost like until something gets really scarce, the water gets scarce, someone, oh my gosh, we got a big crisis because, you know, you go way back, we created that crisis in one way or another because of our land use or because of our emissions or a whole bunch of things. And all of a sudden, oh, we're faced with this big crisis. What do we do? So we try to have a little fix here, a little fix there, and it's a losing game. We're creating crises faster than we can do little fixes, and there aren't fixes for some of the things we're doing.
Then, of course, there are lots of issues of social justice that come in, because take the case of Cape Town in South Africa. It may be the first city in the world to run out of water in just a few weeks.
But it's temporary. It's probably temporary, but it's it is temporary. That those occurrences are coming within Cape Town.
My point, David, was a different one, that the rich people in Cape Town are still lounging around their swimming pools and watering their lawns. People in the poor areas of town are going with their buckets to the public fountains. And if you're wealthy, you can think that there is no problem. But ultimately, it will come to haunt everybody, hopefully, you know, there will be enough lessons coming up.
How do we remedy something like this? You talked about disseminating and outreach and education.
Mm-hmm.
But is there something else that you'd want to mention about? If there is a remedy, I have to ask the question just in case. I know it's complicated. But.
Yeah, no, and unfortunately, I don't think that there is a remedy that doesn't go through really a majority of people, both the general public and the ones in power, coming to terms with the fact that we really got on the wrong track. A track that is ultimately, and we're already seeing it in abundance, is totally self-destructive. Mm-hmm. You know, the level of denial can be tremendous, so that you get people like, I don't know, Elon Musk wanting to explore a possibility for bringing people to Mars because, well, you know, the planet is going to get destroyed, so let's go somewhere else in the solar system. That is the utmost of denial, rather than saying, okay, what have we been doing wrong? And can we live in a different way?
We put this money towards making a difference here.
Well, that's where you guys go.
Yeah. Get on your one-way flight to Mars.
Yeah.
That's right. Let us take care of stuff here. People also need to realize that you can make radical changes and make them happily. Be happy. Have a fulfilling life, even if it's not a life filled with stuff, but maybe filled with relations and relations to other people, reconnection with your natural surround, and getting your recognition from doing good things for society and for the planet, rather than, you know, for how much money you made and what kind of extravagant way of life you're conducting. And, it seems so far-fetched when we look at how we're living now. It seems like, you know, you're dreaming. This is never going to happen. But we've caused a mess, and we can also start getting out of the mess. It's just a matter of a little switch. It's just as big and as little as that, I think. And changes have happened that you thought would never possibly happen, so it's not completely unimaginable, but it is a kind of way of waking up to something that we used to know and have forgotten. It's not
It's not novelty. It's really, and this is one case in which to go forward, in a way, you may need to go back and kind of dig deeper into our heritage as a species, and remember things that were absolutely crucial that made life possible. It may not have been as easy as we have it now, but again, that's kind of backcasting. You know, you know how you live now, and you think, oh, now what are you saying? Go back to living in caves? Well, it was funny because someone wrote again in our local paper with that very argument. So what are you saying, you environmentalists? Should we go back to living in caves? Well, there are lots of people around, the millions of people around the world who actually do live in caves today. And it's a very ecological way of living. It's cool in the summer and warm in the winter. So, but, you know, that's partly facetious, but there's a lot that we need to remember, kind of really species memory almost, to realize that this change is possible and that it's not going to be a sacrifice. It requires big change, for sure, but it doesn't have to be a sacrifice. It may be something that we can do joyously and really enjoy life more. So that's what drives me and me and David in writing this book. It's not a book about doom and gloom that we're writing, although you have to face squarely what is happening. You know, you can't hide away from that. The hope lies precisely in the fact that we can make the change and that we can make it happily.